Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trades as sold through Diamond to retailers for April 2015. As always, this is what's selling into stores, not what's selling out of stores, which is good because I like stores having stuff on the shelves. It's graphic novels, hardcovers, soft covers, omnibuses, digests, you name it, whatever they feel like putting on the list. Per usual, it's kind of a rough four-way split this time around, TJ. Image Comics, though, top of the thing, top of the list, largest percentage of the units, with 31.38% of the total units for the top 300 trades. That equates to about 140,554 units.
Yeah, I think, this is continuing the trend that we've seen recently, you know, with Image releasing, you know, at least three or four number one issues every month. You know, in 5 to 6 months, that adds up to a new trade. So they are putting out quite a few items to order. So you kind of see this trade train getting started.
And it's cool because, I mean, a lot of these things, even if it's just a miniseries or whatever, they're getting some good buzz. And I think a lot of people are enjoying the fact that over at Image, they're, like you said, there's something new every month. Mm-hmm. And it's actually new, mm-hmm. because it's not like a Marvel or DC thing where it's just a new number one of an existing property or one they're dusting off from years gone by. Mm-hmm. When Image comes out with a new concept, it's new, unique, and different, mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool.
Yeah. The interesting thing will be, we've talked about this a little in the past, and obviously for the big two, I think DC does a better job in terms of reprinting, especially their evergreens. Marvel, not so much. They actually have seeded quite a bit of the book market and the trade market, especially outside the direct market, because of their refusal to carry enough stock or to reprint. But it will be interesting to see, because of the Image model where the creators have to take the financial risk. For a few years down the line, you know, initially when these trades sell well for these new series, of course the creators will keep them in print. But down the line, if they want to reprint, the Image comes to them and asks for a chunk of money or things like that. It'll be interesting to see how long you can keep these in print.
Well, I think where they've got the advantage is it comes down to Image and the creators are the only people who really have to decide for any individual title.
That's true.
And they're deciding for their individual title. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples, they're the ones deciding, does Saga get another trade, you know, go back into print or whatever. They don't care how Walking Dead is doing or whether it makes more sense to print one of those.
That's true.
Marvel and DC, they got to look at that big picture, and it may not make sense to do another printing of that third volume of Starman, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, they need to put that money to doing another printing of, you know, a Sandman or something else. Mm-hmm.
The reason I bring it up is because I'm actually not a fan of these series, but the old Image series like Witchblade or Spawn, sometimes some of the trades are harder to find. And now I know that, you know, for Spawn and others, they've been repackaging them into hardcovers or compendiums so that you can kind of still get a hold of the story, and obviously digital can help fill in too. But some of the stuff that has, you know, almost hundreds of issues, and if the creators don't choose to repeat, you fall into that loophole where that Kirkman refuses to fall into. Well, if volume 3 is out of print in a 17-volume series, you know, that's a really bad idea.
Well, but I think that's also why Kirkman's sales tend to be better than some of these other titles and publishers and creators. There is no stumbling block. No matter which format you got onto Walking Dead on, mm-hmm. you can keep going.
Yeah.
You know, it really turns me off as a reader to be, you know, investing in a series. And I've only done this a few times on trade paperback, but Nicolai Dante is a good example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like 11 trades long. I'm missing a couple because it was a joint production between DC and 2000 AD. DC's no longer got that agreement, 2000 AD. So at the very least, if I ever find copies, odds are they're going to be in a new trade dress, so it won't look the same. You know, and that's if and when they 2080 actually gets around to printing them on their own.
Gotcha.
So it turns me off. It's easy as a consumer to feel a little burned, and that's not good.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, Image just has a wide library of stuff, and I think they're in a position to keep more of it in print, and it behooves the individual creators to take up the burden of making sure that there's an interest in that and that it's available.
Yeah, and I've also something I've read online where the publisher Eric Stevens has talked about is as Image has grown over the last few years, they've been able to use the economy of scale to get much better deals for their printing, for their and stocking and warehousing for their trades, and it has enabled them to really push the trades, obviously outside the direct market. But that economy of scale has allowed them to, you know, to help the creators if they do have to do a reprint, it can have it much cheaper than it used to be.
Yeah. Well, that economy of scale is something that I really don't think most of the publishers and creators in the back half of previews fully appreciate the power of.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody could come along and become essentially an umbrella publisher that basically has an incredibly light touch.
Mm-hmm.
All they do is the publishers do what they do as per normal, but they go through this agency, this umbrella company, that has that economy of scale. Because imagine if most of the back half went through one company that was able to get a better printing deal through that volume, better marketing and promotional stuff in previews and outside of previews,
mm-hmm.
and that basically it's just a cooperative, but something that again. Is like Image, but on the scale of the back half of previews.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, you know, the discounts these guys could give would be better and more competitive with DC, Marvel, Image, and so forth, because they've got better printing deals, they've got more leverage within Diamond, that kind of a deal.
Yeah, and I think it also matters that I think certain publishers prioritize keeping things in print. I'll give you an example. Oni Press, as far as I'm concerned, does a pretty good job of keeping their backlist in print, especially considering how small they are.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I read the Wasteland series, which was a 60-issue series that just finished up a few months ago, and I read it in the apocalyptic hardcovers. And I know I remember pre-ordering the fourth one, and I did that to get the discount, but I didn't have the first three. And I, you know, initially looked online, and the first or second one was out of print, but then in the next solicits they solicited a reprinting of it. So they do a good job versus I've run into trouble sometimes with IDW, especially hardcovers. They're decent about reprinting paperbacks, but with hardcovers from IDW, a lot of times they won't reprint them.
Well, I always like it when I see a trade, particularly when it's a later volume. And it's like, oh, wow, that looks interesting. How did it fly beneath my radar for so long? If when I see, hey, it's volume 4, if right there in the solicit and previews it says also available, volume 2, 3, and 1, you know,
mm-hmm.
to where it's like, okay, I'll order all 4.
Yeah.
You know, it used to happen a lot more,
mm-hmm.
But the consumer order form used to be like twice as long.
Yeah.
And then I forget how long ago it was, but at one point, they basically pulled the backlist stuff out of the consumer order form. You can still get it very easily as a retailer,
mm-hmm.
but it's not in front of the consumers and the readers like us.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the best things that Image does is when they're soliciting a new trade, like let's say trade 4, on the same page, they usually offer the first 3 trades again or the first hardcover. And the other thing they really do that's nice is as long as Image is published – the creator's previous work. If the creator is starting a new series, they will also resolicit a lot of their previous material. Therefore, if you're a fan of that person and you had just, you know, either coming back to them, whatever, you're like, oh, look, they've done 5 things and I've missed the last 3. I'll pick those up as well as this first issue.
One of the things, I believe it's in the back couple of pages of Copperhead, is ads essentially for Jay Faerber's other works.
Mm-hmm.
Same idea. If you like this, you might like this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it should be done more often.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, that was one of the areas that I thought Convergence, and I'm suspecting Secret Wars as well, kind of dropped the ball on. Gosh, this Civil War thing sounds interesting. Well, point me to the trade or the other stories or whatever. In some cases like that, it's obvious it's the name of the title or whatever. In other cases, it's not so much. Amazing Spider-Man, Renew Your Vows. Do you know what storyline to go to that's referencing? Or that maybe you want to check out the Spider-Girl stuff because it's essentially possibly that girl older. You know, things like that. With Convergence, gee, the Crime Syndicate sounds cool. Where can I find out more about them?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of leveraging of interest, that's, I think it's completely under the control of the publishers. It's smart in-house marketing to be doing. I don't think it's hard for it to be highly effective because at that point you're preaching to the choir.
I agree.
Let's see, the publisher with the second largest amount of units was DC Comics. They had 27.19% of the units, followed by Marvel with 22.81% of the units. Now, by units, it's Image DC Marvel. By dollars, it's Marvel DC Image. And this, of course, is reflecting a difference in average price. Image only accounted for 23.19% of the total retail dollars for the top 300. DC 29.54% of those dollars, and Marvel 30.13% of the dollars. Now, the average price over at Marvel was $26.21. DC $24.51. Image, and I think this goes to why they're moving more product, their average price was only $15.83. So about $10 less than Marvel and DC. Mm-hmm. On average. Now, granted, DC also had one item that was $195, so that kind of skewed it a little. And Marvel had some stuff at just under $100, whereas the highest cost item for Image this month was $59.99. Mm-hmm. Then if we look at everybody else on the list, they total up to 18.62% of the units and 17.13% of the dollars. This is another one of those cases, not as bad as on the comic side, but if a store only deals with DC, Marvel, Image, Dark Horse, and IDW, just the front half publishers, that's accounting for over 90% of the unit sales in the top 300 and over 92% of the dollars. It's just not that profitable at the moment, for them to be investing heavily in the smaller publishers.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I push pre-ordering. This is why it's like, let's make sure people are aware of the items during the solicitation cycle. For some of these publishers, even ones that have a decently high profile for being in the back half, you know, Valiant, Titan, Oni, stuff like that, it's still easy to miss some of their stuff.
Yeah. It will be interesting, I think, over the next 6 months to a year to follow Titan because they've really put a lot of effort to push into the previews and have quite a few pages now. And they have a number of pages that kind of not only give you descriptions, but show you some of the art. And they kind of developing their own section, like some of the front half publishers. And it'll be interesting to see if that push translates into actual, you know, sales.
How much of their stuff are you reading? Any?
I read some of the Doctor Who comics, and I occasionally will pick up the hardcovers. They actually do a pretty good job of bringing over European and UK comics. And mm-hmm. So they'll have, you know, standalone stories. The problem I have with Titan is they tend to price their stuff a little more expensive. Now, because I buy in hardcover and trade, that's where I feel, you know,
yeah.
Their single issues are usually $3.99, which is pretty normal for a back half publisher for a single issue. But for their hardcovers and trades, they tend to be a little bit more expensive. And because they're a smaller publisher, they don't get as much of a discount through GCBS. So I do have to watch my budget when it comes to Titan Comics. So I might pick up one book a month or one book every other month.
When you said they don't get as much of a discount through GCBS, I want to clarify one thing. Mm-hmm. They don't offer as much of a discount through Diamond.
Yes.
Which is why DCBS isn't able to give the same discount they give for Marvel and DC.
Oh, yes. That's exactly what I mean. But
yeah.
From the purchasing perspective, if I can get a $30 hardcover from another publisher for 50% off versus 25% or 30% off, that sometimes can sway whether I pick up one thing or another, or I put it on put the item on my wish list and, you know, buy it with birthday money or save up to do it. So, you know, for people that have a pretty strict budget like myself, sometimes the amount off you can get really will sour you on a book. And I know that sounds weird because if it looks good, you should get it. But, you know, a lot of us have to stick within a budget. So.
No, I totally get it. I mean, absolutely makes sense. I mean, I've got a budget. I'm not going to say it's strict, and it's certainly bigger than is sensible. I'll admit to that. But there are times it's like, you know, am I willing to pay this much for that item?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's well, and like you said, different things, different publishers are competing with each other. Anytime IDW's got one of these artist editions out, well, that's a pretty good chunk of change that eats into my budget of acceptable, you know, how much will I indulge this month.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's other stuff, yeah, I got to pick and choose.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the artist editions, because those are something that are definitely alluring to me. Like I see those and I'm like, wow, that would be amazing to own. But then I realize how much other stuff I would have to cut from my monthly order to afford one of those, because they're pretty expensive.
That was one of the reasons why even back, geez, I'm trying to think how far back this was. This would have been sometime maybe in the 90s when the DC Archives and the Marvel Masterworks were getting rolling. Getting one of those hardcovers just about doubled how much I spent in a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, these are cool. It's great to have the older material, but it's doubling how much I'm spending in a week. And it got to the point, it's like, you know, I'm going to stop. I did. Because it's both how much are you spending, and then percentage wise, is it just, you know, tipping the apple cart kind of a deal?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's cool to get the nicer premium type formats and stuff, but I also think it's smart when the publishers have lower price point things to get the stuff accessible.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't think that Titan is, you know, trying to, you know, price their stuff way too aggressively. It's just because I choose to buy comics in this format, you know, certain publishers definitely publish things more expensively, you know, and not to say that they don't publish a good product. The few hardcovers that I have from Titan are really well made. And I actually, under knowing that, having tried a few of their items, I actually don't have a problem paying a little bit more because I know that I'm going to get a good product. But, you know, still operating within a budget, sometimes you just have to pick and choose your battles.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think one of the decisions Titan has made, because, I mean, they've been around as a publisher for many, many years, but really only, I'm going to say, in the last two or three have they gotten what I would consider incredibly serious about being a comic book publisher.
Mm-hmm.
They picked up the Doctor Who license and stuff like that. Before, it's, yeah, once in a while they'll have something. But they've been doing a very good job maintaining the physical quality of their stuff,
mm-hmm.
as well as the content quality of their stuff. So, you know, I feel comfortable. Gosh, it's from Titan. I think it's going to be well done.
Mm-hmm.
Once a company loses that, then it's a bit of a crapshoot as to, is this going to be amateurish or not? Is it going to be well done or not? That changes the dynamic quite a bit right there on the purchasing decision.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think, though, you're right, that Titan Comics is a publisher to keep an eye on, because I think, I mean, they only had, you know, 0.21% of the units and under 0.25% of the dollars for the top 300.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got Doctor Who. They're going really well with that. It wouldn't surprise me if they were to branch out to Torchwood or some other licensed properties and stuff. They've already shown they can handle that well. As a matter of fact, they're picking up Blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they could easily grow over the next year or two into one of these publishers that does some great creator-owned stuff. Scarlet Couture is a new series coming out by Des Taylor and stuff. Wonderful looking book.
Mm-hmm.
And do the licensed stuff and get to where it kind of like how Dynamite and IDW and a few of these other publishers have kind of grown over the years.
Yeah. And it's also important to remember that this is just the direct market, these numbers we have here. And one of the things that I've noticed about Titan is that the way that they publish quite a few standalone stories or complete, you know, they may collect in Europe and England, they do what they call the Bande Dessinée, which is kind of like each issue is like 50 pages, and they may just collect the whole series in one hardcover and sell that quite well in the bookstore. Like I've seen quite a bit of increase in the number of titles from Titan I see at the Barnes & Noble. So, you know, every once in a while, there's a Barnes & Noble a couple miles from my house, and I go there and I browse the graphic novel section just to see. And, you know, obviously, the vast majority of what they have is DC and Marvel, but they do actually have quite a decent selection of indie stuff, and I see a lot more of the Titan stuff popping up. And some of that's because the way that they're publishing their material, lends it to be able to the bookstore be able to make a decent amount of profit off that, and it makes a good presentation. It's an all-in-one story. You get your beginning, middle, and end, and you don't have to worry about this being volume one of 12.
Well, and again, with something like Doctor Who, that's something that I think appeals to mass market audience mm-hmm. as much or more than the direct market. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see where they go. I think, like I said, they're an up-and-coming, and I could see out of all the publishers kind of in the back half right now, Titan being one of the ones that a ways from now could easily move into the front half if it desired to and grew successfully.
Mm-hmm.
So, shall we take a look at the actual top trades list?
Yeah.
All right. Starting at the top of the list, as soon as my computer will cooperate with me, it is actually something that tops the list by an incredibly wide margin, and unsurprisingly, it's a volume of Walking Dead. This time it's the volume 23 of the trade paperbacks. With 21,852 units. Now that's off about a third, a little under a third, from where the previous volume has sold, factoring on all the reorders and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as we well know, Walking Dead, its opening numbers not only are starting out incredibly strong. I mean, again, 21,852 units. If you were to put that on the comic book side this month, that would be rank somewhere around 139.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would have sold about as well. It would have sold only slightly less than, say, Magneto and Moon Knight, better than Silver Surfer, Avengers World, and a few things like that.
Yeah. And it's important to remember, too, that while, you know, the volume 23 may have started off with only 21,000 units, still in the top 10 is the first volume of Walking Dead trade. You know, 121st time on the list with, you know, 5,000 more orders and a total of 356. And that's just since you've been recording it in this era. And that's just in the direct market. So that volume will continue to sell quite well.
And this is only what was reported sales. That one came out long enough ago that they were still only doing, what, the top 10, 25 items, 50 yeah. items.
Yeah.
So this thing, even if it's not in the top 10, it's like always on the list.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look a few ranks further down, you see Saga Volumes 1, 2, and 3 trade paperbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Other Image books are starting to do this kind of evergreen approach that prior to recently with Image, it was more or less, you know, Walking Dead and, say, some Vertigo books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not – I mean, if you go – To you were mentioning Barnes & Noble and their graphic novel selection. If you go into a random Barnes & Noble or local bookstore, if you can still find one of those, go to their graphic novel section. Look at their selection of DC books and Marvel books. You're going to see essentially the high-profile books and characters.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to find the run-of-the-mill, mid-tier kind of a book.
Oh, I completely agree. I think, you know, especially since I'm more of a DC reader, you know, based on how I got into comics, what I notice a lot of is a lot of Batman, a lot of Superman, you know, current stuff, obviously mm-hmm. 52. And then actually they have a decent selection of Vertigo, especially Fables. At the Barnes & Noble near my house, they actually have quite a few of the Fables trade paperbacks.
Well, if you look at the third item on the list,
yeah.
It's Fables Volume 21 trade paperback, 7,555 units. That's got, I guess, one more trade and then the final issue, or is the final issue going to be that next trade? I forget
which. The final issue is the next trade, the 100,
okay.
180 pages,
yeah.
last issue slash trade.
I'm glad, I think it was you who were the one who mentioned that on the preview spotlight. I just about sailed past it looking for the, you know, for issue 150 of Fables.
Mm-hmm.
But leave it to Willingham to do it as a complete trade in and of itself. I haven't decided if that'll live on my bookshelf or in my comic book boxes with the rest of Fables.
I was actually just going to ask you that, is how have you decided to, you're going to jam it in your box or you're going to put it on the wall or the bookcase?
I'll probably wind up putting it in the comic box.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is my comics are much better organized than my collection of trades.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a sad thought in a couple of respects, in so much as since around the time of the new 52 starting, I'm just filling up short boxes and, you know, in almost chronological order by a shipping week or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been scanning those into to Collector Z's comic collector program. My trades, on the other hand, are on bookcases, kind of these over here I've read, these over here I want to read. And then there's a increasingly precarious stack of recent acquisitions that I am very glad I no longer live in earthquake country.
Yeah, and it makes sense to put it in the box considering you only have one of them. You know what I mean? Whereas you have 149 issues of Fables and then you have one trade kind of thing.
If I don't do that, at some point I'm going to be going through and wondering, well, why don't I have issue 150? I know it went that far. I can't tell you how many times I've done that and found out, like, well, I didn't think I missed this issue of an Image book, or how come I don't have issue, 28 of Red Lanterns?
Yeah.
Because it was issue 28 of Green Lantern as well.
Yeah. Well, and with how often now Marvel is restarting, you got to remember what volume you're in and if this is the right one with that one.
I get hit by that doubly so, because not only for my personal collection trying to keep that straight, but also trying to clean up the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Trying not to have different volumes collide with each other. I've almost got that under control on the comics side, but I'll admit to do that, I've had to let the trade side slip a little.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. It's confusing sometimes. Okay, so we've talked about items 1 and 3 in the list and how we went from 21,852 with Walking Dead to 7,555 with Fables. Mm-hmm. In between those two, we've got the Avengers Rage of Ultron original graphic novel hardcover, 10,934 units. Now, in most months, Fables would have been enough to top the list.
Mm-hmm.
In the few months it wouldn't have been, Avengers certainly would have been, unless something like, Walking Dead or maybe Saga when it first comes out sometimes. So really strong top of the list this time with just those three. I mean, that's over 40,000 units between those three items. I have the Avengers Rage of Ultron original graphic novel, I think, in that increasingly precarious stack of books. Have not read it yet.
Yeah, I believe it's obviously not meant to be a direct tie-in, but I thought it was kind of like meant to be a companion to the movie because it was released about the same time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Actually, a little before because it came out on April 1st.
Okay.
But I think they were trying to leverage the interest and, hey, Ultron's being big in the movie. Let's do something with him in the comic side.
Mm-hmm.
And I like doing, when they do original graphic novels. That's something I don't think Marvel and DC really leverage as much as they could and I think should, because it allows you to tell some stories that just don't work as well if they're serialized out or it takes too long to serialize out.
Mm-hmm.
What else do we have in the top 10? We've got Batman Volume 5, Zero Year Dark City, trade paperback at 6,827 units. Now what's interesting is that's only about half the total sales of the previous volume, which also has the reorders included. Which is accumulated up to 14,187.
Mm-hmm.
So either that was a more interesting storyline or people just don't rush out and buy the Batman stuff the minute it comes out like they appear to be doing with, say, Walking Dead.
Yeah, I think for that one, for Volume 5 of Batman, it was basically the conclusion to the Zero Year
mm-hmm.
storyline. So I think that might have I would think that actually would sell better because people would want to get their hands on that second half. Although I have had some people complain to me that they felt one of the problems with Scott Snyder's run on Batman is that things have been somewhat drawn out after the Court of Owls, and that, what could have been told in maybe 6 to 8 issues has been told in 12 to 16. And, yeah. When people say that to me, what I say is, do you honestly think that the higher ups at DC don't do a lot of planning when it comes to their premier book like Batman? I mean, Batman is a huge chunk of DC. And so I'm sure they do let him have freedom because he's done a great job in that book, but that they have to be constantly looking at where that book is going and what's going on.
That may be part of the problem.
Yeah.
One of the stories I've heard about the Clone Saga back in, not the original one with Spider-Man, but the Ben Reilly return and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Was that Marvel's higher-ups were keeping a close eye on it. It was selling really well. So they would go down to editorial and say, keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. And it was still selling well. Keep it going. So they did. Somewhere on the internet, there is a series of articles. I think it's called The Life of Reilly. It's The Life of Ben Reilly, really. And it's the behind-the-scenes stuff. It was written by one of the editors or assistant editors at the time. So it's insider information as to some of what went on behind the scenes, where they originally planned to go. It was only supposed to go 6 issues, but it went for a year and a half or whatever. Fascinating read. But I do think part of why some of these storylines play out as much as they do is just the trade paperback format in general. You know, they want something they can collect 6 issues-ish of and have a decent story. And then at that point, you know, you've gotten to where it's essentially the equivalent of a book instead of a short story. Well, you know, books have storylines that run through multiple books. Let's have it run through multiple trade paperbacks. You know, it becomes where one trade is act one of a larger story.
Yeah.
And of course, that means when you've read it in the comic side, you're getting, you know, act one, you know, subsection two or something, which sometimes drives me nuts.
Yeah, the decompression is much more common nowadays. And just, you know, one of the things that it's funny when I listen to the other, you know, comic book page podcasts, and I know Drew talks about it a lot, and I know Sam talks about it sometimes, especially with things like Convergence and quite a few of the DC books I know lately have kind of not done so well in terms of being able to tell a good, fast-paced story.
I was about to mention Convergence anyways, but I'm thinking, do I want to go there or not? We're going there. I don't think it's a matter of could it tell a good fast-paced story. It could it even tell a good slow-paced story? And I, for my money, it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
At least as far as I've gotten, how the various miniseries have tied in, whatever. I don't know if it's just people are getting used to longer, more drawn-out stories, because it's not just comics. You know, films tend to be trilogies or epic sagas or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just sequels, but, oh, this is the opening act of a bigger, you know, thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, movies getting split into a part one, part two kind of a deal.
Well, look what happened to The Hobbit. It was a 200-page book that got made into a 9-hour movie. Three 2-hour movies.
Anytime I read a novel that's, say, 250 or so pages, and I get a 2-hour movie, I realize they've had to cut about half the novel out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you take The Hobbit. Okay, you're going to need a certain amount of time. 4 hours, maybe, but 9, yeah. But part of it is it can take, you know, a few sentences to say these two armies clash or whatever, and it takes a little while for that to play out on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a matter of, I think, as an audience, we're accustomed to bigger, more, I don't say more epic stories, but more involved stories.
Mm-hmm.
Arcs on a TV season. You know, those are incredibly common.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think with the price point of some of the trades, certainly the price point of the comics, that's a harder pill to swallow these days than back when, ironically, things were cheaper. You also got complete stories in a given issue. They could build to something. You know, look at the Kree-Skrull War. Mm-hmm. That took a couple issues to tell, but every issue, man, a ton happens in there. You know, with today's decompressed story, every one of those issues would be the equivalent of a trade paperback in length now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to wonder if that's impacting sales in a not-so-great way.
Well, I think, you know, as these comic companies have been bought by large entertainment conglomerates, you know, with The Hobbit, for instance, The Hobbit movie, mm-hmm. is when they were initially making the first movie, it ran over budget hugely. And one of the reasons they made multiple movies was to amortize the cost, to spread out the cost of all the special effects and all the stuff that Peter Jackson was doing so that they could recoup that expense. And I think that in some ways, these big entertainment companies do the same thing. Obviously, you know, in my opinion, Marvel and DC primarily now are IP mines for their, you know, television and movies. And, you know, I think there is a sense of, well, keep it going and keep it going. And as long as we can keep making these movies, you can kind of piddle along.
Well, I think that's the nature of serialized storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you serialize it so you can recoup the investment in the creation. But with a movie, particularly something like The Hobbit, which is just a huge multi, you know, mega million dollar, you know, blockbuster kind of a thing. I look at some of these things on the comic book side and you factor in the page rate, the printing, whatever. You're not talking all that much money,
mm-hmm.
that it makes sense to get that first issue out as quickly as possible before you've even gotten the second one done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing when you've got, you know, like an Image title or something, they get a first issue out, something happens, they don't get a second. It's another thing entirely when that's happening at Marvel or DC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Secret Six. It launched. It got an issue or two. The second issue was late. Then they've resolicited and skipped over Convergence, just hoping to give the creative team, I guess, time to catch up.
Yeah, that has been a weird one for sure.
And it's not the only time they've had a false start on a title.
Yeah.
You know, they had solicited Justice League 3000, mm-hmm. canceled, resolicited. You know, it happens. Sometimes they just want to go in a different direction, have a different artist, whatever, or they need more time. But it comes down to basic project planning.
Yeah. I'll give you an example that I think a series that they've completely botched. And I'm sure once I read it in absolute edition, it'll be gorgeous because J.H. Williams III art is always gorgeous. But the Sandman Overture has just been a disaster. I mean, for the amount of money that DC has, why couldn't they have just let those creators make the six issues, not tell anyone about it, then do a big build-up campaign to get everyone stoked and release, literally get them all six done, because you knew that with J.H. Williams, his art is very time-consuming, mm-hmm. and then with the author, I'm forgetting the top of his name off the top of my head, but Neil Gaiman, sorry.
Yeah.
With Neil Gaiman, you know, sometimes he, you know, I remember reading articles about the original Sandman. Sometimes it would be late because he just didn't turn his scripts in on time. But with that, with how much that they advertised that and, you know, tried to push it and say this is going to be the next big thing at Vertigo, they just botched it so badly.
Oh, I agree entirely. You know, it can't even maintain an every other month schedule.
Yeah.
It's killed the story momentum for me.
Well, and that's the thing is I trust those creators and I'm sure it will probably read well in trade. But for people who read single issues, I'm sure it's been a frustrating experience. But for me, just seeing it from the outside, I'm like, man, that's going to make an awesome hardcover to put on my shelf and read. But for people who are buying it in single issues, I would have been frustrated.
Yeah. No, as somebody doing that, I am frustrated. And you're right. They're a big enough company. It's a big enough high profile thing. Why not get all those issues collected yeah. in-house, ready to go, and not miss a beat?
Well, and the other thing, too, is they spent so much – you could tell they spent a bunch of money on PR and getting it – you know, it was all over the comics media when they announced it. And to think all that time and effort they spent to do that was literally wasted on their releasing schedule. They couldn't have banked, you know, a couple $100,000, paid these guys, and yes – you write it in the red column for 6 months to a year, and then you release it one issue a month, and you make it all up. I just don't understand that.
Well, again, it's. I mean, I hope for you know DC Entertainment, part of the Time Warner Empire, that cash flow for that wouldn't be a serious problem.
Yeah, you'd hope not.
I would hope not, but I mean, maybe it is. It just seems like doing that though. Gives a more satisfying reading experience. It makes them look better. It's what you're paying for is better PR
mm-hmm.
because you don't have the fiasco they've got now, and it's not the first time they've had it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing when the last issue of a series or midway through something goes awry, but again, you can build in the lead time for this. You know, there's it. They were able to get comics out on time. Back in the days, they had to be literally FedExing and physically moving pages around.
Yeah.
With the internet and things essentially traveling practically at the speed of light, there's no technological reason for some of the delays that used to be in the past. Oh, we just didn't get the pages in time to send them to the printer or whatever. That doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't happen anymore. But, you know, that's something to me that I'm sure I've mentioned this in the past. As a software developer, one of the big pushes in that industry is going agile. It's a certain methodology. And it basically boils down to doing some things to where if you're off track, you realize it soon, early.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't these publishers, particularly for something like that, hey, J.H. William, when you're done with that next page of Sandman Overture, just shoot it our way. You know, let us just keep us abreast of how you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're done at the end of the day, upload to a server so we can see what's going on. Then they know, oh, well, it's taking a little longer than we thought. Maybe we should do something about that. Oh, it's going swimmingly. He's ahead of schedule. Let's do something about that, you know, because there are a couple of times it seems like certain creators, doesn't happen often, but seem to just get almost wildly ahead of schedule on the scripts or on whatever because they can actually manage their time. You can take advantage of that sometimes. Either get stuff out sooner or schedule them for other work or, you know, whatever. There's lessons that could be learned, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it may just be caught up in, you know, the big bureaucracy of a big company, and, you know, maybe the creators assured them that things would be coming out on time and they believed them because they were such big creators, and, you know, things just kind of got screwed up.
It happens, and I've seen it happen to some big creators, either through illness or just, you know, other things.
Mm-hmm.
But you look it over at Boom and the George Perez series. He has had some times in his career where scheduling was a problem, you know, getting stuff out on time or getting it released on time. I'm pretty sure they held out until they had everything that they were positive they could do in every other month release. And I don't think there have been any delays on it as a result. I haven't checked, so I could be wrong on that, but I don't think I am. That's the responsible way to do it.
Yeah. And I'll give you another example. Number six on the list, the Jupiter's Legacy, Volume 1, which sold about 6,090 copies, had Frank Quietly on art. And the last issue was, what, 2 or 3 months late?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. At least. I think it was longer than that, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, in the trade, you know, I know that that series, I think, is kind of – he's doing standalone series with that. I think the next – I can't remember the title of the next series in the Jupiter's
Circle.
Jupiter's Circle, yeah, which I think actually has a different artist. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they're able to get a good amount of reorder on this Jupiter's Legacy, you know, if it's a completely standalone.
Well, when America's Got Powers came out – I'm forgetting who the writer was on that, but that's a high-profile guy over in the UK. He got the artist on that was Hitch, right?
Yes.
And the last couple issues came out late, and the writer, it's like, well, who could have foreseen this? And people are like, well, let's see, anyone who's ever followed any aspect of Hitch's career, brilliant artist, great stuff, not the most timely sometimes. You know, you can chart. In some case, well, I mean, Wildstorm, when they were relaunching some of the books, and I think it was The Authority. Two issues came out, and then that entire relaunch essentially fizzled because stuff just never came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really bad, particularly if the financial people at these companies are trying to project income down the line based on, well, we get this done at this point, we should have this trade at this point, therefore we should have this income at this point, allowing us to go do this, that, and the other.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make those plans if you don't know when things are coming out.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, you know, when you look at the writer for that Jupiter's Legacy, Mark Millar, you know, he's kind of got an interesting thing. You know, he's made quite a bit of money from his movies, and he's kind of – he has this – you know, I've read interviews with him. He has this idea that he likes to do a lot of different things and see what sticks. So he has, you know, Starlight with Goran Parlov. He's got Chrononauts going with Sean Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting that he does these kind of these tight 5 to 6 issue stories, and he's looking to get them optioned. And, you know, he's looking for these different things. And if one really starts selling well, maybe he'll continue it. But as far as, you know, the stuff I've read lately from Millar, he's really trying to, you know, tie these volumes off at the end and say, hey, this is a standalone thing. And if you liked it, if enough people liked it a lot, you know, maybe we'll get some entertainment interest in it. And then also if it sells really well, you know, we can go for volume 2. Or if not, then I'll just move on to something else. You know, Starlight ended. Chrononauts is kind of right in the middle right now. And I think he's had a few other things. Like you said, the second Jupiter's Legacy or Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just an interesting perspective. And he's kind of hedging his bets by obviously having, you know, different artists and kind of trying to play against that issue of not being able to get the work in.
Well, it's a smart thing for a writer to do because, I mean, it's not uncommon or unheard of for a writer to be able to do a book a week. It's really uncommon, if not unheard of, for an artist to be able to do that.
Yeah, unless you're Jack Kirby. But
I was going to go with Sergio Aragonés, but
yeah.
You know, there are a couple that have been able to do like 2 books a month.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking Leonard Kirk was one of them. Who else? There have been a couple that are just have been really good artists and unbelievably prolific.
Mm-hmm.
A matter of fact, another one of those, Stepan Sejic, in addition to doing comics work, he had the second volume of his original graphic novel series, Sunstone, down at rank 17.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to, and this is stuff I think he's worked on the side for quite some time, get enough to do a trade, kick it out, much like how Mike Norton is doing Battle Pug. know, I think that's also potentially a web-first sort of a thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that is a webcomic that he publishes hardcovers every so often through Dark Horse.
Yeah. I think another one's in the next previews.
Yeah, volume 4, I believe. Yeah.
I think so, yeah. But, I mean, what a great way to do it. Get something where you're just doing a page a week or, you know, whatever their schedule is. That builds up into a full-blown, you know, hardcover or whatever in a reasonable time frame. You know, it's slow and steady wins the race on some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see other creators that, man, years go by before they come back with that next issue, which, again, really frustrating. Let's see, what else do we have on here that looks interesting?
One that I saw was the actual number 10, which is Lumberjanes, which was, especially in the comics media, was one of the kind of breakout hits for Boom. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, being in the top 10 is probably pretty good for Boom for a trade. And I know that I've heard a lot of good things, especially from female readers, about that series, the Lumberjanes. And actually, when the series started, it was just going to be a 4-issue miniseries, but because they had such good demand in digital and obviously in the single issues, they put it into an ongoing. And you know, this trade collects the first 4 issues, but it's been a pretty good you know, teen and young kids series.
Yeah, it's something that's really working for them. So I mean, keeping it going just makes sense. Now, one thing that's kind of interesting to compare sometimes, and I happen to have the list this time around handy, BookScan does the top 20 graphic novels every month. And it's a very different sort of a list than we tend to get through the Diamond list. Now, the Diamond stuff is, let's compare kind of what the two lists are. We're looking here at the top 300 trades invoiced to comic book specialty stores in predominantly North America. Whereas the BookScan stuff is, what are the top 20 graphic novels that sold through mass market retailers to end consumers?
Mm-hmm.
So it's remotely possible that comic shops got all 21,852 of these Walking Dead things and none of them moved. We know that's absolutely not the case, but in theory. Whereas you look at the BookScan stuff, if it says it's the top thing, that means more readers bought it than, you know, anything else. If you look at rank 5 on the BookScan stuff, and I'm going to jump to that, it's Ms. Marvel Volume 2 from Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
That is down at rank 59.
Yep.
On the Diamond list, and its reorder activity.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes me wonder, did it just take longer to get to the mass market? It's also a different audience.
Yes.
Because rank 15 in BookScan was the Avengers Rage of Ultron hardcover that we've already talked about at rank number 2.
Yeah. And actually, to answer your first question, I know that for DC and Marvel, oftentimes the general book market, like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, will get the books usually at least a couple weeks later than the direct market. Now, there are occasions when that's not true, and that just depends on different publishers' contracts with their distributors or whatnot. But I know for DC and Marvel, it's pretty usual to have the direct market get the material first, at least a couple weeks, if not like 1 month kind of thing.
And that makes sense. It's a smart business move.
Yeah.
Because those are guaranteed sales, whereas BookScan, there's a bit more risk.
Yeah.
You're getting them into bookstores. One or two publishers have nearly gone out of business when stores did massive returns at one point. Yes.
And I think it's a way for especially the big two to show that they, you know, or at least, you know, pretend when you're a giant corporation that they're interested in the needs of the direct market.
I hope that they actually are interested in the needs of the direct market, because I think without the comic book shop infrastructure, comic books as we know them, and by extension graphic novels, trades, hardcovers, almost evaporates, not overnight, but in pretty short order.
Mm-hmm.
Because what facilitated that Walking Dead at the top of the list here on the Diamond side is the monthly issues. Now, Kirkman with the TV show and all the other work he's doing and stuff, he's doing all right. But while he could continue doing Walking Dead and go straight to trade, go for the book market and stuff like that, if the comic shop just kind of that system evaporated, would he be getting the return on the investment? Would he be getting the cash flow timeliness and stuff that he's used to or whatever on the comic side? Is it worth his while to do that? I mean, there are a couple of times in the past where there's been a comic that ought to have cost the creator next to nothing to do. And even if it doesn't have a massive return on the investment, it wasn't much of an investment. The one I'm thinking of in particular was PvP Online from Scott Kurtz through Image. Webcomic, collect it, put it out. Now, I'm sure there's a lot more to it of which ones do we do. Maybe it's got to be touched up, get it ready for print, whatever. But he equated that at one point to essentially just beer money or what have you. You know, nice additional income, but not something essential. And it just wasn't worth his while to continue the comic. You know, and that's one, again, he's already done the heavy lifting by putting together the webcomic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that decision just made no sense to me. But if you don't have the comics to serialize the stuff out, get back that return on the investment for the content creation, it's harder to get to these trades to get out to the mass market.
Mm-hmm.
So while certain books are going to skew better in one direction than another, certainly widely known properties, Batman, the Avengers, etc., anything with movies or TV show tie-ins, they'll do fine on BookScan.
Mm-hmm.
But you're never going to see things like middle-of-the-road title, you know, pick it from whichever company you want, you know, a Catwoman, Batgirl, I'm trying to think of some good middle-of-the-road, you know, Black Widow, Elektra, Storm, those types of titles. I'm picking all female ones, but it's equally applicable to almost anything. Avengers World, Spider-Man and the X-Men, Red Hood and the Outlaws, that kind of stuff. Anything that's just at 20,000, 30,000-ish seller, you're not going to have any real traction in the mass market on those. Unless, of course, they become a movie or TV show property, and then, even then you might not.
Yeah. What I'm interested is, if we have, especially for Marvel, since we don't really know how DC is going to do with their movies in the next year or two, but especially for Marvel, do you want – this is what I worry about. I wonder if Marvel has a sustained success, and I'm talking not like 1 or 2 years, but 5 to 10 years of successful movies. Now, I also – you know, saying that, I know that that's highly unlikely in the movie business to have that much success for that long. But if they did, do you think that there might be an executive somewhere at Disney who says, eh, this couple $1 million line item for Marvel, do we really need this? Can't we spin this off? Or, you know, we've got all the IP rights for these movies. Do we really need to keep funding this? I'm just wondering if there will come a point where someone who's not a comics reader, who's just an executive, and, you know, after if they have a lot of years of success with the movies, if they'll think, eh, what do we really need this side of the thing for?
I think that's absolutely a risk. I think we've even seen a few publishers that have done that. Radical is a good example of that. They did a number of comics. They finally got one through to movie format with Hercules, Dwayne Johnson won, and they'd already ramped down the comic side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Marvel and DC, a little bit different kettle of fish, because those properties all, you know, have a long, deep history on the comic side, but they're having so much more success at DC with Arrow, Flash, the upcoming Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, iZombie's already going, even Constantine, it only went a year, but still, they've got a strong foothold on television.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, do they get a whole lot coming out of the comic stuff? And I can see an executive, and I think it's a bad decision, but I could easily see an executive saying, why are we spending money on this? It's a loss leader at best. Let's cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the argument the people on the comic side should be making is that they're the R&D division. They're the ones creating the new properties, getting the stuff out there, finding what has legs, what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, two fallacies with that. One, nothing has legs in comics anymore. Nothing lasts for any length of time to say, yep, this is worth promoting to TV and film. So that's a hard sell, I think. And the other is, how often are we actually getting new properties at Marvel and DC? How much of it is just regurgitation or twists on old stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do another version of Superman, Batman, Wonder, you know, whatever. We're getting more creative and inventiveness sometimes out of the film stuff, but it's also a higher investment to go try that.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at the Marvel, which is part of Disney and stuff, and you look at what's going on there in the past, and some of their original properties at Disney, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, etc., you know, they ran as comics or were run as comics for a long time, helped the popularity of the characters, whatever. But they've also outsourced that for eons. So I think it's absolutely possible at some point that Marvel could wake up and say, you know, maybe it's worth having these comics, but it's not worth our time to do it. We want to spend the time doing the movies or whatever. I mean, witness one of the Marvel Knights imprints or whatever, when they had outsourced to eventually what was Event Comics and said, okay, why don't you guys go take some of the street-level heroes, run with it, see what you do. We got new takes on Daredevil, Punisher, Moon Knight, and it really revitalized that section. For that matter, they farmed out during the Heroes Reborn stuff, Avengers, Fantastic Four, Iron Man, and Thor.
Mm-hmm.
So, absolutely, I think it's possible that a non-comic fan executive at either company, Marvel or DC, from their higher up, could say, you know, you're not adding to the corporate IP library. You're not bringing in tons and tons of cash. Why are we keeping you around? And the company's having a hard time justifying.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that doesn't happen. I think it's a bad thing. But if I were running DC or Marvel, one of my goals would be to change that, to make it to where new properties are coming out. But to do that, you've got to make it worth the creator's time to invent new villains, new heroes, new characters, new stories, and stuff like that. Versus, okay, let's just have Superman, you know, fight Lex Luthor again, or Batman fight the Joker again. You can do brilliant stories that way. You're not growing the IP library.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting topic, actually, that really kind of highlights the part of the success of Image over the last couple of years is that, you know, with the internet and with chat rooms and things like that, a lot of creators have been able to talk to each other and learn what kind of deals in terms of percentages on trades or residuals or whatever percent if the character, a new character they create goes in a movie. And you can see that it's hard for Marvel and DC to get creators to voluntarily create new characters that they don't have a significant stake in. Because, you know, DC and Marvel being the big conglomerate, they want to own 100% of the new character. But when the creators see what people do with new characters at Image and they see the potential, i.e. Saga and Walking Dead, they see the potential, you know, not everything's going to go that way, but the potential, I would be very hesitant to create a character for Marvel or DC, especially with the history of, you know, the 70s, 80s of creators creating these characters and then just getting pennies on the dollar when those character blows up in terms of financial reward for the company.
There's two or three case studies worth a quick discussion of. The first one is Harley Quinn, created in part by Bruce Timm for the Batman animated series. And the character successfully got moved into the comics, has kind of exploded in popularity there over the decades, in video games, about to be in a movie. So one of the biggest additions to the Batman mythos in recent decades. And he was just doing his job, just creating a character for a story. And essentially got, you know, rewarded per that. And I've seen some interviews where he's talking about that, and he seems a little understanding. That was the deal. He understood it at the time, but also equally miffed of, yeah, but look at how they're leveraging that. That character's worth a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to have the end impact of squelching his creativity to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas whatever reasonable amount DC could have given him, or Time Warner for that matter, for the value of that property such that he felt fairly rewarded, or at least people would justifiably say, hey, you're getting a little greedy now, would have paid off in spades if he had created 2, 3, 4, or 5 other such popular characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's a case in which they could have done better. And there have been stories about how Paul Levitz had tried to rectify such situations as he became aware of them and kind of smooth things over with various creators.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, Gary Conway had some choice words, which he since kind of apologized for ascribing bad motives to certain people's, you know, decisions as to why things happen, but around the payment of for characters that are getting used on TV and movies and stuff, the leverage in other places, specifically Flash and Arrow. One of the things he mentioned was the Caitlin Snow character on Flash, who is presumably going to become Killer Frost in the comics. As of, I think, the New 52, Killer Frost was Caitlin Snow. prior to that, there was one or two versions of Killer Frost. I forget the name. I think Crystal Frost was the original one, but I could be wrong on that. That Gary Conway created back in the original Firestorm the Nuclear Man series in the 70s. But that's not the version they're using on Flash. He mm-hmm. doesn't get a percentage. But the new version, Caitlin Snow, is a derivative character. So Sterling Gates and whichever artist helped create that version, they don't get a slice of the pie. Now, whether that's getting rectified or not, I hope so. I'm not positive. I'd have to reread some articles. But that's the kind of thing. Be a little, I don't say overly generous, but be a little generous in this respect as a company. Make these people feel like it's worth their time to go create a new character. Mm-hmm. Now, part of what came to light is it was conveyed to Conway, perhaps incorrectly so, I'm still unclear on a few of the details, that to be getting paid for some of these characters that are getting used on these shows, you had to go and file a separate filing for each character you wanted remuneration on. And what I learned in this article was Felicity Smoke in Arrow. That was a character Jerry Conway created as part of the Fury of Firestorm or Firestorm the Nuclear Man, whichever the second series that lasted about 100 issues was. Because I was always thinking she was original to the TV show. But when he mentioned that and described, oh yeah, this is the character who had a software company, did this, this is how interacted with Firestorm, then this happened, this, and like, I remember those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Same character, different character. It depends where you draw the line. It's a different use of this earlier version of the same character, younger version of the same character, if you know what I mean. But is it realistic to expect every creator, particularly people who worked back in the 70s and 80s, where a lot more characters were getting created than today, to go file for every one of the hundreds and hundreds of characters they've ever created on the off chance they may someday get used in a TV show or movie or whatever? No, I mean, come on. It's on, I think, the company's legal team at Marvel and DC to be making sure people are fairly compensated.
Yeah, and I think that especially for the big two, they, with the amount of material they put out, they have huge spreadsheets that clearly delineates who wrote, who, you know, the pencils, inker, you know, color, all that. They have huge databases that do all that. They have to. I mean, otherwise their business would have crashed into the ground years ago.
Well, Marvel has such a thing. It's actually a graph database. So it's not even a typical relational database. I was recently watching a video about kind of the technical challenges they face. And some of it for older stuff, it's like, well, we're not totally sure who created it, but they can credit who created Hawkeye.
Mm-hmm.
And deal with the question of, well, which Hawkeye are you talking about? You know? So, I mean, there are serious technical challenges to those logistics, but by being proactive and a little generous in that respect, because again, these are corporate entities that are huge. They have resources, and the reason they have resources is because creators created characters that we love to read stories about, watch on TV, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get it to where it's worth their while to try to make a lasting mark in your universe gets better and better and better. You know, I would be really hard pressed after reading, 4 years or so of the New 52 to really count up more than 24 original characters. And Aquaman, the others from Aquaman would be about a third of that. That's something that, again, long term doesn't make sense. If the company is not cultivating new intellectual properties, and that's one of the easiest ways to justify keeping a comic publishing around as part of a corporate, you know, empire, entertainment empire, it just seems like there's a missed opportunity there.
Because
I think we've shown or have seen that well thought out comics and characters and stuff can easily be successfully interpreted on television and movies very, very successfully.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, you take James Cameron out of the mix and the Avengers is the top grossing movie. You keep him in the mix, then you've got Titanic and Avatar, but still. I would be proactive on creator rights. I just think it's the right move, and it's easy if you handle that well to make it very encouraging for creators to create new stuff. Part of why Image has the success they're having is it's ironic because I'm suggesting doing all this stuff so a company can grow its intellectual property library. Image has no intellectual property library. Well, technically, it's got the Image Eye,
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So everything they're doing, all the success they're having, is because the creators are fiscally vested in the success of their work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge difference for one of these image books to get out there and these creators say, yep, let's push this, let's do this, let's go with that, and are incentivized to do that versus similar sort of creator working on a Marvel or DC book. They turn in the work, they're done.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the need, by and large, or the benefit to heavily promote it. So that, to me, that part of the system is fundamentally broken.
Yeah, I agree.
That's also why by the time we drop out of the top 20, we're nearly below 3,000 units on the trade side.
Which is about one or less copies per store, correct?
Thereabouts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still a little unclear exactly how many stores are out there. I would love if there was a way we could figure out as a podcasting community. Between podcasters, bloggers, etc., there's a lot of us on a fan level. If we were to somehow get a little organized, I think we could easily do a one-day census of comic shops.
Yeah. It's too bad that the Find My Comic Shop, that kind of website thing, doesn't release stats or anything like that.
To me, the first stat is how many shops are there. From there, I'd love to know which point of sale system they use.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I'd like to work with some of the people who do the point of sale systems to be able to do a book scan-ish equivalent for comics. Because, man, the amount of data I think I could mine out of end user transactions at a granular level, that person X bought, you know, the original Sin trade paperback, they bought the first three issues of Convergence, then stopped, and they did this on this weekly basis, then they went here, or, you know, when Aquaman and the other came out, they stopped buying Aquaman. You know, whatever that data has, it could be so illuminating about reading habits as to be crazy useful for publishers.
Like today, make you want.
It's something where I think more information is potentially very beneficial for the industry, but it's just hard to get that. What else looks interesting on the list?
I found number 68.
Uh-huh.
And that is Miracle Man Volume 3, Olympus. And the reason I wanted to highlight this is this has been a series that I did not read. It was before my time as a comic reader.
Okay.
But one of the things that's been interesting to me is when they re-released this, you know, they finally went through all that League of drama and spent all that money to either acquire the rights or, you know, basically with the backing of Disney's money, you know, basically make it ill-advised to challenge who really owned the rights or whatever version of what they did. And they started putting the issues out at like $4.99. And yes, they were higher page count, but a lot of the page count extras was like process pages and, you know, extra covers and things like that. And then the hard covers have gotten progressively more expensive. And my issue with this is I'm just waiting for an omnibus because the most that they charge for their omnibus is $125, and which will collect all the material. And it just seems like Marvel's really been shooting itself in the foot with the, you know, reprinting of the Miracle Man material. And I'm not sure if that's they have to recoup those costs or if they just misjudged how many people were interested in reading it again versus how many people who couldn't get it before and just ended up pirating it online to read it.
I hope that didn't happen, but I think it's definitely a risk because of how long it was unavailable. But I think they handled it poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And back when it came out in the 80s, it was cutting edge, brilliant stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading it in the monthly format as it's been re-released.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's all right, but I'd already read it.
Mm-hmm.
So it lacked the punch of not having been read before. First read, different, you know, sensation. But also, it's much like what happened to the John Carter movie, where people would see it and say, yeah, but I've seen all this stuff before. It's derivative of Star Wars. It's derivative of this, that, and the other. Ignoring the fact that that movie was, as best I know, a reasonably faithful adaptation of a story that was written 100 years ago.
Yeah, it was published in like 1901 was the official book. Yeah.
So Miracle Man may seem a little derivative today of things like the authority of, whatever you've got, but it was what started the movement to allow for other things to be told later that are derivative of it in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who can't read it through with the understanding of it came first compared to some other stuff,
mm-hmm.
I can see where it certainly doesn't have the punch that people would have expected.
Yeah, for me, it was interesting because when I first saw the way they were pricing the single issues and then the trades, you know, I think the first trade was $29.95 and then they just kind of slowly escalated. And I think part of that was because they didn't have as many buyers. You know, for some of these items that they know that they're not going to sell a huge amount of, I believe that they raised the price to kind of recoup some of their investment, even if they know that they're not going to sell as many copies, you know, kind of get the people they know that are going to buy these no matter what. And the reason I wanted to highlight it is, you know, I read the first couple trades. I actually checked them out of the library and read them. And I was actually really impressed with the material in terms of, you know, I knew that I had seen some stuff, you know, lately, the last, you know, 5 to 10 years that was comparable. But to know when this was published, I was like, wow, I'd really like to read this. But just the way that they were pricing things and the release schedule, I was like, I'm just going to wait for an omnibus because I'm going to get the whole story and it's going to be much cheaper for me to buy it that way. So I think that they've mishandled some of that, but it may just be because they have to recoup the cost they've invested to acquire the property.
But if that's the case, one, they should have rethought about acquiring it at that price.
Mm-hmm.
And two, don't you think they might have recouped it better if they had done maybe not an omnibus, but a couple of things up front, some nice high-end slipcase editions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do the glitzy format first, later go to lower formats, the trade, paperback, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But do that inside of, say, the initial six-month window that they've got it in print, and then get to where, okay, now we're going to start telling new stories.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to do the cutting edge stuff of today with this character. Versus right now, you're looking at stuff that was done with an older printing technology and therefore doesn't look as vibrant and cool as today's comics. You've got backup material that's either just sketches of the cover or stuff with token text around, yeah, this is a sketch of the cover. So I figured that part out. Thank you. Or reprints of early Miracle Man original stuff, which was literally just a rename or a riff on the Shazam stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the extra features usually kind of annoyed me. I think they would have been better off cutting the price and just doing the reprinting the issue without the extras, or do them in two per, you know, issue or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious how much of a market there is for new Miracle Man stuff based on how they've been handling the property.
Well, and I think there were some other issues that were kind of involved too. I think that some of the series was recolored. And then another big, I think, plus that people were talking about when it was first announced was that when they finally get up to near the end, I guess, I'm not completely familiar with how the series played out, but I believe that they have said that Neil Gaiman will finish his story because his story was unfinished, or one of the big writers, I know Alan Moore wrote on this series, I know Neil Gaiman did, but I think there is the end of one of the series, they're going to continue and finish it off.
But will anyone care by the time it gets to that point?
Yeah, and to be honest with you, with the way that that it's been selling, they may decide that that's not worth their time or money again, and they may just cancel that.
I think they would have been better off, like I said, doing a going after the collector high-end market first,
mm-hmm.
and then quickly getting it, saying, hey, yeah, we're going to give you guys, you've been waiting for a nice glitzy edition, here it is. Don't worry, guys, those who can't afford it or want the trade, we'll be doing that in this order. And then, come Christmas or, you know, whenever, here comes the new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And do it while there was still a lot of interest versus while they've been doing just basic reprints. I mean, everything they've done with the property, by and large, is something that a production assistant or production person could have done solo with no editorial direction whatsoever, almost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe picking the stuff to put in the back, whatever. But still, it's I think, set the property off on the wrong foot for people who hadn't read it back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Which is unfortunate, but hey, it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Their publishing program for that definitely turned me off and made me kind of, you know, I'm just waiting for the big final edition, you know, so.
It's one that I've been getting the stuff, but wondering, should I really have been doing that? If I had been in a position where I needed to cut back, that would have been dropped so fast.
Gotcha.
Because I've got the original issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's interesting, a little further down on the list, we are seeing a couple of event sort of things showing up on the list. Kingdom Come, Old Man Logan down around ranks 143, 144.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think Convergence and Secret Wars is getting some renewed interest in that.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to a second to the Miracle Man stuff, another thing that was done by Grant Morrison, I think it was, early on, was Zenith over in 2000 AD.
Mm-hmm.
Phase 3, the third hardcover, is at rank 153, okay, and it sold 992 units. This is a four-phase kind of a thing, and it's kind of his early superhero-ish kind of work. I've got those first three trades. I'm waiting for that fourth, and at some point I may plow through those. So if somebody's interested in maybe doing a back-issue spotlight or something on that at some point,
mm-hmm,
I'm certainly willing to consider that. But that's another one where how does it hold up over time? It may work better for me since I've never read it before.
Yeah, I've never read that either, but I have seen those hardcovers in the local comic book store, and they're pretty nice hardcovers.
Yeah, they are. They've got a good design to it. There's a consistency on the spine. Mm-hmm. I like how they've got the Z logo going on and such. It was one where they clearly thought out how the four would look on the shelf.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talk about it occasionally. I haven't talked about it for a while. I really do think that shelf appeal for trades and hardcovers is very important.
Oh, yeah. Trade dress is a huge, huge issue.
I mean, how the spines look on the shelf. You know, one of the things that visually separates the manga section from a graphic novel section in a bookstore. Mangas are a uniform size and shape. Yep, the spine changes look a little when it goes from series to series. But it feels orderly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas comics, different heights, different sizes. You got trades, you got hardcovers. You know, it's a mishmash. It seems chaotic. It seems disorganized.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes you see the same sort of thing on, like, DVD collections. Multiple seasons, it seems to be a flow, a nice thing. Other times, it's just, they went kind of by rote. It's like, okay, here's the character, the lead character's photo, here's the name, here's the season number, what's the big deal? You know, uninspired.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am no expert in trade dress for either comics or trades, but having read and consumed many of each, I certainly have some opinions, some strong, some not so strong.
Yeah, no, as I collect in hardcover and trade pretty exclusively, trade dress is a huge issue for me. You know, one company that usually does a pretty good job is Vertigo. Vertigo, especially when they do a lot of their deluxe hardcovers, you know, of their long-running series like DMZ, Scalped, or 100 Bullets, they do a pretty solid job of that. One company that kind of missed out a little bit was, I believe, IDW. What was the Gabriel Rodriguez and Joe Hill series? I forgot.
Lock and Key?
No. Yeah, Lock and Key. Like the first two or three had great, the hardcovers had great trade dress. And then all of a sudden, like the fourth, or I think it was the fourth volume, and the first three were all black and had, you know, different coloring numbers and lettering, but was all appropriate. And then the third or fourth volume was white. And then the last two were black again. So it was like, what happened with the fourth volume? It was really random.
Yeah, that would frustrate me.
Yeah.
One person I think that deserves to be called out for doing, you know, above and beyond in terms of consistency of trade dress is, I believe the credit would go to Paul Levitz on the Spirit Archives.
Mm-hmm.
Because when that switched publishers, they kept the trade dress was able to be kept. And it was done explicitly so it looks nice on the shelf and stuff. But, you know, that was one of those cases where I think potentially from a personal point of view, Paul Levitz just wanted it that way and was in a position to make it that way. Because that was one of those things that, you know, I was there at San Diego when Levitz signed the deal for DC to be able to do the Spirit Archives initially or whatever. And then when it moved, did it move from or to Kitchen Sink? I guess whichever. It seemed to be he personally had an attachment to that work, that character, that stuff, and therefore kind of shepherded it and made sure that good decisions were getting made. Whereas I often wonder if sometimes the production, the graphic design people doing the trade dress at DC and Marvel are just, you know, wanting to spice things up, shake it up, do it a little different from volume to volume or something.
Mm-hmm.
And man, if I were publishing, I would take some serious time on trade dress up front for consistency. And try to build in the plans of, well, if we need to change the logo, how do we do that where it's not disruptive and stuff?
And it's one of those things where you know, putting in a little bit of effort can really go a long way. Like I said, like I have an entire shelf where I just keep my Vertigo, you know, deluxe hardcovers. And it's like one of my favorite shelves. And I, you know, I'm a big Vertigo fan, so I reread those comics anyways. But, you know, it's just a great part of my collection that I look at. And, you know, it's one of the biggest positives that I like about that is that they really pay attention to that. And they don't cheap out on it, and they don't kind of blow it.
There was a publisher in, I think, the 90s, Broadway Comics. It was Jim Shooter's company. Was it Broadway or was it Defiant? I might be thinking Defiant. It was one of his ones after Valiant. And I think it went Valiant, Defiant, Broadway. I think the next one would have been Persistent or whatever. But the trade dress on their comic, it just had a nice basic black border. That's where they put a little text on what the title was, whatever. And it's something that it was across all their books. Looking at the rack, you could instantly spot that's one of their books, that's one of their books, that's one of their books. You know, and it was unobtrusive. So again, good trade dress. I think it's worth its weight.
You know, when I look at rank 127, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about DC's TV success. The reprint and reorder of iZombie Volume 1, which, you know, at 1,214 copies doesn't seem like a lot, but when you look at the total of 5,573, that's actually quite a substantial reorder for how many it sold in the past. And that's a December 2010 item.
Well, and if you look down at rank 281, the second volume's also got some reorder activity. Mm-hmm. So that TV show is definitely getting some renewed interest in that series.
Yes.
I never read that series. I have yet to watch the TV show. It's been highly recommended to me by a couple of people, including Sam. You know, Rob Thomas, who did Veronica Mars, is behind the show. So I'm expecting it to have a good sensibility I like. Rose McIver, the lead, she was a Power Ranger for a season in Power Rangers RPM. Did a great job there. So good cast, good people behind the scenes. I'm looking forward to it. I just got to find the time to watch.
Yeah, I have watched a few episodes, and it's very procedural, at least at the beginning. They have kind of woven in more of the underlying storyline as the episodes have gone on. And if you did like Veronica Mars, it has very similar kind of theme and tone.
I love Veronica Mars. I thought it was an exceptionally well-done show.
Yeah,
it had a episode on it with my sister. Prior to watching it, I had driven by various key locations in the San Diego area where it was filmed 1 year before Comic-Con, because the people we were hanging out with, Chance, big fans of the show, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I was aware of the show before I had seen the show.
Yeah.
Now, with iZombie, have you read the comic?
Yes, actually, before it was even, you know, announced to be a movie, a TV show, I had read the comic because it's
Vertigo.
Vertigo series, and I was, you know, almost any Vertigo series I'll give a shot, and I did like it. Primarily the reason I liked it was the art. I forget the name of the artist. It's
Michael Allred.
Yes, Michael Allred. And actually, one of the cool things about the TV show is that it's very apparent that they've taken some of his art, and I don't know if he did new art for it or if they use some of the stuff he's already had existing, and they used it for the show's intro. So you know how they, you know, like with Arrow or the Flash, they have, you know,
the
images
logo
and things
or whatever,
like that.
Yeah,
and so they actually have kind of like moving comic Flash, you know, splash pages almost that kind of lead into each of the beginning scenes, and it's the title. It's really cool. You should check it out.
I've gotta watch the show, and I think I should check out the comic too.
Yeah. I think your sister would like the show as well.
That's part of why I haven't just watched it myself, is I want her to watch it with me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking she'll like it too. I hope so. Rest assured, if we watch, we will record about it once we finish the season.
That makes sense.
But there are many such episodes to come. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to highlight that because I thought it was interesting. You know, we oftentimes talk about, you know, not necessarily on the trades podcast, but all of the comic book page podcasts. And it's often a discussion in the forum about, you know, does the entertainment media sell, you know, extra issues? Does it drive people to the market? Well, you know, for, you know, the iZombie, considering that this trade is sold, at least in the direct market, about 5,500 copies, 1,200 extra copies on reorder is a pretty substantial reorder. And it'll be interesting to see if comic book shops were interested in stocking these volumes to for potential growth or if they had confirmed interest beforehand.
That would be interesting, yeah. I may want to at some point do a little bit of digging to see if iZombie would show up periodically on the trades list before the TV show, or if this is indeed something we could clearly attribute that got the renewed interest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to bet it probably did. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, 540 units for that second volume, and it was, what, 1,214 for that first volume.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, again, you got people watching the show. I can definitely see them saying, hey, I'd like to check that out.
Yeah. Well, I just thought, you know, when you see 1,200, you're not exactly impressed. But when you compare it to the total previous sales from a trade that's been out for 5+ years, you know, mm-hmm. that just to me kind of makes, oh, looks like at least some of the comics retailers were cognizant of there being a show and were like, well, we'll stock some of these trades. And I don't know about the back end for DC and Diamond, but they might have also, DC might have given a little bit sweeter discount if you reordered some of the trades, you know, to kind of induce that.
That's actually a good question. If we filter the list to that price point of $14.99 and look at the retail ranking,
mm-hmm.
well, the item above it and below it, which are Walking Dead volumes, have retail rankings of 226 and 232 versus 176 for iZombie,
mm-hmm.
implying that first volume had some incentives for discounting, and it was invoiced at a lower price.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly given that it sold like two copies less than The Walking Dead above it.
Mm-hmm.
The second volume has a retail rank of 370, and the item below it. So the two items below it have a retail rank of 469 and 386. What I'm thinking happened is it too was discounted a bit because the other one that had a 386, that's another DC book that they may have just blown out.
Mm-hmm.
But if it gets the thing out there into more hands, again, mm-hmm. there's, it went for, how many volumes would that have gone for? A total of four?
I believe four. Yeah.
Total known sales for the first volume, including this month's reorder, 5,573. Second volume, 3,323. Third volume, 2,212. Fourth volume, 1,868.
Mm-hmm.
So it definitely fell off. But if you look at first month's sales, a little under 3,500 for the first one, a little under 2,800. A little over 2,200, and then again that 1,864, whatever. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere it snuck in a few reorder items on that last one.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing to realize about iZombie, at least in the comics world, was they had to somewhat prematurely wrap the series up because I don't know if you remember, but Chris Roberson had a falling out with DC.
Yeah, I remember that. I'm trying to remember what caused that.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure if it was his work on this or if it was he just stopped believing in the work-for-hire model. Because, you know, he went on to do Monkey Brain comics with his wife and do other things. And I don't think he does a lot of work-for-hire anymore. So, you know, this series kind of, I believe, was truncated because of that was part of the reason.
Well, and again, it's a shame when that kind of stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the creators feel they're not getting a decent deal out of it, they take their toys and go home, mm-hmm. or leave their toys and go home.
Mm-hmm.
And that nobody really wins on that.
Yeah.
Looking down at the price points, man, they are just all over the board with the clear preference in terms of what sold the most being or the number of items, at least, $14.99. It had about a quarter of the list, 24.33% of the list, the top 300. $19.99 and $14.99 each had, you know, $19.99 had 11.67% of the list, 10.33% to $24.99.
Mm-hmm.
So just between those three price points, we account for a little over 46% of the items on the list. But we've got stuff as low as $6.99, stuff again as high as that $195 item, which of course I feel obligated to go find out what are those items at those two ends of the spectrum.
The $195 is the Frank Miller Ronin Gallery Edition, so it's at $289.
Uh-huh.
So that's that big, you know, it's basically DC saw how successful IDW's with the artist editions, as well as Dark Horse has also started their own artist gallery editions.
That's so right.
It's basically once the other big publishers that had iconic work saw how successful and how much money IDW must have been pulling in, because while they don't, you know, those artist editions from IDW are sold on net. So like they charge $125 and DCBS maybe gives you 10%, maybe nothing.
Well, they're charged on net. And what that means is DCBS buys them at a flat price.
Mm-hmm.
Typically what happens is there's a cover price and stores get a discount. Here it's almost the inverse. Mm-hmm. They buy it at a price and then they mark it up.
Yeah.
I think DCBS usually only marks it up about 25%, whereas I've seen it marked up higher at other places.
Gotcha.
So I think they do a fairer job, because, I mean, that's a 25% quote-unquote discount from what they charge to what they pay. I mean, that's reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the interesting thing is that, you know, the other publishers have seen how successful it is. So Dark Horse started their own series. You know, they have not necessarily the Hellboy one, but they've doing like the Usagi Yojimbo. They're doing one. DC decided to do the, you know, gallery editions. And then there was, I can't remember. There was another company that was also doing them, kind of seeing how successful they were. They wanted to jump in on that. Oh, actually, now I remember is Marvel actually entered an agreement with IDW to start producing some of their own, kind of like almost as a licensed artist edition seller. And I think there's either in this month's previews or the next round of solicits, there was the first book of that with the Marvel through IDW artist edition kind of thing.
I was thinking as I started to look through the June solicits that there were a few more high ticket items like that than I was thinking there ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
In so much as that really stretches what I laughingly call a budget.
Yeah.
It's tough. These things are cool. I mean, I never really got into Ronin, the series. I'll be honest, I'm not the world's biggest Frank Miller fan either. So that was easy to pass on. But yeah, there are a couple others. I thought they were doing one on one of the first Batman Superman arcs.
Yeah, no, I know that they've I believe this is one of the first gallery editions from DC. And I think they've at least solicited two or three more over the last few months. And, you know, I'm not super familiar because as soon as I see the $195 price tag, that kind of takes it out of my range.
I know that feeling. That's something that easily makes me think, you know, do I really need that? And with the default answer being probably not.
Yeah. When I get to those pages and previews, I go, ooh, that looks amazing. And then I go, oh, look at that price. And I flip the page.
I have gotten to where I either start with the DCBS Excel order form, or sometimes I take the consumer order form off the Diamond site and kind of do a quick slam and through Excel to make it a quasi order form. And it's very tempting to just say, okay, let's filter out the items I ought not to be paying that much for. At the lower end of the price, Penguins of Madagascar Volume 1 from Random House, reorder activity, that's a $6.99 book. The $7.99 books were Disney Fairies Volume 16. Wow. From NBM, and Brody's Ghost Volume 6 from Dark Horse. That one was at rank 270, did 555 units. That is by Mark Crilly, who actually just had a new art book come out that I picked up. I have all of my artistic abilities were surgically removed at a very young age, so I get art books because they're pretty to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was the realism challenge. And he basically goes and says, yeah, I had this thing, you know, here's a crumpled up piece of paper. And he draws exactly what it looks like. So with the lighting, the shading, everything, it's like the guy's skill is crazy good. He's got a fascinating channel on YouTube where what he'll do for those things is two videos. They're the same video, but one of them is like just condensed and sped up. And just, I don't know if it plays music or whatever. It's like you see him at almost a lightning fast pace drawing this thing. And it goes from a blank piece of paper to, you know, he's recreated the thing that was just sitting next to it, amazingly detailed. And then the other one is a full blown real time version where he's walking through the whole process, explaining what he's doing, etc. It's just the guy is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
So Brody's Ghost is one of his original graphic novel series. I think this might be the end of the run. I'm not sure. I hope there's more because it's great stuff. He also did Akiko and the Planet Smoo back in the day and one or two other things. Big fan of his work, obviously. I like his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And again, $7.99 for a essentially a manga-style digest or whatever. It's a hell of a deal. You get it through DCBS, and it's... Again, the cover price is only about twice what you would pay for your average comic from Marvel and DC these days, and you get like four times the content of your average comic.
Yeah, I think it's a smart idea that the way, you know, the publishers that are trying to especially market mostly to kids, they do themselves a service when they have a cheaper price and a good page count.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to return on the investment. If as a parent you give your kid a comic and 5 minutes later they're pestering you because they're bored again, wasn't a good use of the money.
Yeah.
You give them a trade or, you know, a digest, and then they're going for an hour. Awesome.
Yeah.
And as just as a personal reader, if I blast through a book in 15 seconds, I'm like, well, geez, what the hell? You know, if I've got something that I just sink my teeth into and it's like, wow, I'm immersed in this world for a good sizable duration. I feel there was a lot of story. It was fun to explore this world, whatever. That's something I'm going to give more of my money to.
That makes sense.
Yeah. You want to feel like you've spent the money and got something back for it.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, with very young children, it's easy for things like picture books because they have there's a high level of rereadability. But you're absolutely right. Once they get into the middle age and the teenage years, once they read something, they're moving on to the next thing. And it can be very frustrating if it's something that you spent $3.99 on and it's 20 pages of actual story versus a nice little digest that's, you know, maybe 120 pages. You know, it's not the greatest paper, but it's only $6 or $7.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, again, like you said, there's some movies that kids can just sit down, play it, watch it, play it again, watch, you know, that sort of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And there, one of the big wins with the Harry Potter books was kids, and not just kids, adults too, just ate that stuff up. It came out, they had to read it. Mm-hmm. They got immersed in it for hours on end. You know, getting that kind of immersion through a comic book stuff, you've got to go to a trade or a hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Anything else? Or is that...
I just real quick, I wanted to highlight number 145, which is Copra Round 2 from Bergen Street Comics. Sold about 1,062 copies. And the reason I wanted to highlight this is... It's a very, very independent comic by Michael Fife, who has gone on, you know, he does the art and writing for this, but he's gone on to do, I believe, one of the more recent Marvel Ultimate Universe titles. You know, obviously that whole universe is kind of getting shut down, but this is just interesting to me that it sold what I consider pretty well because Bergen Street, the publisher, is just a single comic shop in Brooklyn, New York, who this guy was selling tons of single issues, basically handmade issues, you know, photocopied and mm-hmm. stapled himself and was mailing them out to his mailing list and things. And, you know, he had an Etsy shop, but they kind of took him on and they created their own little press. And he's kind of like their star attraction. And they've been putting out these kind of, you know, pretty decent sized trade paperbacks of like, you know, 5 to 6 issues of this Copra. And it's I have both the round one and round two, and they're great. It's basically a independent version of the Suicide Squad. And that's kind of like the comic that he, as a kid, was in love with. And so it's his version of kind of that. Obviously, he's not copying the stories, but he's got a lot of the characters that have some of the same traits. And, you know, if you want to read a story where, you know, things happen to characters and they stay dead, this is the kind of book you want to read.
That's interesting. I mean, just not just the story about the comic or the contents of it, but yeah. How it came to be.
Yeah, no, he's kind of was... one of up and coming guys who's been really done a good job of selling his comics by himself online. And obviously he, you know, kind of built up a fan base and was able to parlay that into these kind of collected editions. And then, you know, Brian Michael Bendis was a huge fan of this Copra and he brought him to Marvel to start writing books. And so he's been writing for them for the last, I think, 6 months to a year.
One of the best ways to get a job writing stuff or drawing stuff for one of the bigger publishers is mm-hmm. to write or draw something and show that you can do it.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's frankly how he was, you know, Brian Michael Bendis found him is he heard some chatter from other creators and was like, oh, you should check this out. And so he ordered a few of these comics and was like blown away by them and really loved it. And brought him on, said, hey, Marvel editors, Marvel bigwigs, take a look at this guy's stuff. He's good. Let's give him a shot on one of these Ultimate books. And, you know, unfortunately, he started in the Ultimate Universe at a time when that part of Marvel's line was really collapsing. And so, you know, hopefully we'll get to see him on some other stuff, because I think he only got a 6 to 12 issue run, because you know how Marvel is pretty brutal about canceling series that don't sell. So,
yeah, but that may work out really well for him in the long term.
Yeah.
Because it gets him used to the work for hire arrangement, doing stuff from other people's scripts, you know, fitting into that corporate setup.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's been good to work with, if he's panned out for them, they'll use him on other stuff. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Marvel's putting out a lot of books.
Yeah, that's true.
So you got good artists you can rely on. They're worth your weight in gold.
Yeah. So I just wanted to highlight that, just because not only because it's an interesting distribution model, that it's basically a comic shop distributing his stuff, but they've also been able to move a decent amount of copies in the direct market. So.
No, that is cool, particularly the comic shop doing their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's a way for a comic shop to get to raise their visibility to a national level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could either do it by doing like Brian Hibbs has done, doing a lot of articles for years and years on end, like 20 years or whatever. Or you can actually do, again, that kind of a thing where you become known because you're promoting other comics and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. No, thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah.
Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
That'll do it for me.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the monthly question. The Diamond Order Index only owes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or as few as 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as we know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and/or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered the outside scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.